Arch Hiffen was delayed until a plane this morning. Art is a professional and personal audio restorer, has been involved since the 1960s. And he returned full-time to audio restoration after years in digital video sales. He was Northwest Regional Manager for Abacus Video Systems for almost 10 years. He was involved in the discovery and restoration of the previously thought to have been lost soundtrack and picture elements of the original Vitaphone program from 1926. And this was where I had met Art at the 50th anniversary presentation of the first Vitaphone program in 1976 at the Museum of Modern Art. What is interesting now is that he's been involved in donating and restoring Vitaphone short subject soundtracks for the UCLA Film Festival in the summer of 2000 with the cooperation of Eastman House and the Library of Congress, sound and picture elements for films by Waring's Pennsylvanians, The Happiness Boys, and Charles Hackett will be reunited for the first time this summer. And I am really looking forward to seeing that Happiness Boys film. He has developed electrical playback systems for Cylinder Records and was involved in doing some of the restorations of several kinetophone films that were originally filmed in the mid-teens by the Edison Company. And there are units of these playback machines at the Swedish Archive and at Rogers and Ham in New York, and also J. Paul Getty. He's been developing playback equipment, radically redesigning an Ampex AG440 at the recent position that he had at Vitapex, and was involved in while at Ampex in setting up the Ampex Museum, which we had a wonderful time touring when we were in California, I believe in 1985. He has published many papers in Audio Magazine, American Cinematographer, the Society of Motion Picture and Television Engineers. When we were in Nashville, the Country Music Foundation studio was designed and built. He knew Rudy Valli, Raymond Scott, and had access to their collections of recordings. And I think he was just vamped already here. He's also passionate about restoring old American Flyer model trains, American Flyer versus Lionel, which is a very interesting aspect of not going for number one, but going for number two, so to speak. But we've had a talk this morning about one dead format, and now we are going to have a talk about another dead format, wire recordings. But there has been an interesting development, just as we've been seeing some of the manufacture of new replay machines for cylinders. There is now also the development of a new replay machine for wire recordings, and that is the subject of our presentation today. Here's Shiffy.
Came to be coined. For anybody who doesn't know, Ernst Lubitsch used to say "mitout sound" when they would shoot. And we are going to be doing this presentation MOP, mitout picture. But that's okay, because the most important thing that I have for you to hear are some samples, and I'll try to draw you some word pictures. Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to be here. I don't know if you know that I've been kicking around in audio restoration for a very long time and took a very long serious detour in digital video, but came back to where I belong, and I'm happy that I did. But all those years that I was working in digital video things with Ampex and Abacus Video Systems and so forth, I never lost the focus, and I never lost the passion. And starting about 2 years ago, an idea that I had discussed with Pete Hammer at the Ampex Museum many years ago finally went from the back burner into actually getting something accomplished, and that was based on the usual presumption that an analog, and this might even apply to digital recordings in the future, but let's just talk analog for a second, that they could always make a recording in analog that was better than it could be played back for the technology available at the time. An example of this is that superb cylinder machine which is sitting outside in the hallway, which renders the one that I did 20 years ago very primitive by comparison. It's a marvelous instrument. You get better bandwidth and fidelity and so forth playing cylinders electrically than you do with the old equipment. With modern cartridges and the right styli and or laser pickups, you get much better results out of discs and so forth. Well, while at Ampex, we had known, for example, that even early tapes could be improved upon significantly in their playback by having better head design, better preamplifier design, and so forth, where if you took a known original tape that was recorded on a magnetophone or an Ampex 200 from the 40s and played it on an ATR-100, that you got a significantly better response. Well, I decided that finally wire should get some attention. And this really proved to be a very interesting experience because wire is an extremely difficult medium to work with. Recently, and this just happened by sheer serendipity, I was listening to NPR one day while I was working on something, and I heard, oh, they're going to be doing a thing on Norman Corwin, the great writer, director of radio production and so forth. And they had a wonderful stream of consciousness recording that he made not too long ago, and he got into talking about the ramifications of trying to do a series of pre-recorded, edited programs traveling around the world shortly after World War II, and they did it on wire. And even then, with the machines being new and the materials being new, not having been wound up on a tight reel for a half a century, they were always breaking and malfunctioning, and it was a nasty, nasty medium, and it really did deserve to go away. But it turns out that there were some very significant things recorded on wire. And what I mean by significant is subjective, of course. It could have been somebody's wedding. It could have been field recordings. In the case of Arthur Godfrey, all 3,000 of his broadcasts were incredulously recorded on wire rather than tape, and there at the University of Maryland, and everything in between of magnitudes of that type. Well, as you might know, wire goes back to the late 1890s. The first machine, the telegraphone, was developed by Paulson. And it really, in my opinion anyway, didn't remotely come close to state-of-the-art recording phonographically at that time. It lacked electronic amplification in the recording process and in the playback process. But it was a conceptualization that laid the groundwork for everything that we have today, all the way up to contemporary digital tape recording. Well, when you go and try to do something and you're doing it speculatively, you can't go and spend an incredible fortune, which I happen not to have, on just going whole hog and building a whole new machine. But what I decided to do was to take an Ampex AG440, which is a wonderful workhorse of a machine that you are probably familiar with, and radically remachine it so that it can play wire. Not too long ago, I was fishing around on the internet and found a paper written by somebody, and I'm not being coy, I don't remember who wrote it, and because of what I'm about to say about it, if I did remember, I wouldn't say the name anyway, but there was this really sophomoric statement in it that said, well, everybody knows you can't play wire on a tape head, so we just aren't gonna try. Well, I never know anything. I don't like to assume anything other than that things shouldn't be assumed, because sometimes you can be extremely surprised by having a tableau rase and just really starting from ground zero with an objective viewpoint and saying, let's try this Might seem crazy, might be a waste of time, but let's try it. So imagine, if you will, from my PowerPoint demonstration here on the CD, a head assembly, the first one that I did, simply taken off of an Ampex 350 because I had an old 350 lying around. And I took this head assembly and I mounted it on a piece of 3/4-inch wood. And I took a Webcor wire recorder and I simply routed the wire off of the supply reel around this head assembly and then back onto the machine, because the real pain in the neck about wire is the pumping up and down, the bobbing, like as is required with a sewing machine. And I figured, well, why should I spend my time trying to work out the mechanical issues of handling wire unless I can see whether or not there's some satisfactory sonic result? So simply by taking the 350 head assembly off and taking some wood guides and making some notches at the appropriate heights and so forth, I decided to try to run that wire over a full track head. And what I then did was simply take that full track head and plug it into a spare Inovonix Repro Electronics, which is matched for the impedance of that head, and take the line output and see what would happen. And I was absolutely flabbergasted, astonished at the fidelity that came out of this wire. It was really, really amazing. So the premise that you have to have a special head is not correct. It's just not necessary. Obviously, there are some issues of gap width and the width of the coil and so forth, but the fact of some kind of metallic band or string or ribbon running over a head will play into modern electronics and give you much better sound than the originals. Now, the issue that is at hand then is, why is it better? Well, I think the reason why is because the wire recorders that were generally made available to the public in the United States after World War II were extremely mitigated, cheapened products relative to what they could have done. Magnacord, which is a wonderful name you might remember that unfortunately didn't survive, most people do not know that their very first product was not a tape machine, it was a wire recorder. And it was called the SD-1. And the internal company notes that survive from Magnacord specifically state that it was SD because it was a super-duper wiring machine. I'm not making this up. And it was a rack-mounted monster that ran at the standard speed of 24 IPS and with the pull of a lever at double speed to 48. And because it used the Armor AC bias patents, it was recording nominally flat. And what I mean by nominally flat, at 48 IPS, something on the order of 50 to 13,000 cycles, plus or minus two. Wonderful medium. But you had to run it at 48 IPS. And it was rack mounted and it had balanced I/O and all that stuff, and very few of the machines were sold because it came just at about the segue of tape becoming seriously recognized in the United States. But because of companies like Webcor, so many of these other machines made it into the field that people started using them, and certainly for certain considerations, they could be more reliable and certainly more convenient than lugging around disc lathes. And as an example, I recently salvaged some wires that were recorded by a sociologist, musicologist in the Birmingham, Alabama area, and you'll hear a sample in a little bit, of this exquisite raw talent that only could be played on wire. Now, getting back to the design of these machines, as you know, for those of you who've seen them, what they did was they had the head bobbing up and down to act as a bobbin. And that is, in my opinion, the significant Achilles heel of that design, because heads are microphonic. And when you have a head moving, if you just put a tape, cue up an analog tape, or even a digital tape, onto a machine and tension it up and just flick the tape, you will hear all kinds of spurious sounds. And that is happening continuously when you are playing wire on a conventional machine. The head is moving up and down, introducing microphonic distortions. The wire is being mechanically biased against the head as it's being moved up and down. And one of the things that you will typically hear superimposed on these things is a kind of metallic tinkling sound, which is a result of that microphonic distortion. So that's a problem. The second problem is that they were rim-driven. They were not capstan-driven. So the speed stability was extremely inaccurate. Now, that was another problem to overcome. Yet another problem is that you have this extremely tensile material wound for about a half a century on this little core that at most is about 2 inches in diameter for a typical wire machine. And you have wires that were creased, bent, and so forth, knotted with that good old square knot technique that Webcor used to recommend. And so you have these wires that have these bends and kinks and so forth. Stands to reason that if you can play the wire under significantly increased tension, that a lot of these distortions will be either eliminated or seriously diminished. So the challenge then was, how do we make a transport that will handle this stuff, which is 4/1000ths of an inch in diameter, that easily breaks, that's supposed to run at a very fast linear speed of 24 IPS? And yes, in the little summary I gave Mike, to be sure that he mentioned my interest in trains, which is my other love, they are relevant to this interest because a friend of my dad's was involved for many years in the management of an enormous machine shop. And he introduced me over the course of years to several gentlemen, all retired, who happened to have little shops in their homes and so forth. And one guy in particular, a guy in Northport, Long Island, his name is Charlie Neuscheller, a remarkable guy, passionately cares about the quality of work that he does, intellectually sharp and curious, and likes to do things that are unusual and likes to do things well. So we fortunately have a relationship where I throw tons of money in his direction, as I can afford to, and say, Charlie, try this. And he'll look at the drawing, he'll listen to my description, and usually insult me because it seems stupid. And then he'll give me precious feedback. Because he'll say, for example, oh, well, you're trying to do this? Well, at Fairchild in 1952, we made a machine that did so-and-so. And he'll take these principles that he had encountered over all these years and hybridize them and integrate them into my ideas, which are only ideas. I can't implement things other than the very first experiment of take the head assembly off the Ampex, cut a groove in a piece of wood, and see if you can make the wire run. After that, to make a machine that's reliable and professional takes the skill of professional engineers and mechanics and so forth. So think of me only as a kind of a producer of the wire show. Well, I apologize to you because the machine is, again, in one of its mutating states of growing into a nice, powerful device. I really wanted it to be here with me. And I just couldn't make it, and we're going to try next time. Well, if it's not showable next time, I'm in trouble. The original concept was not, by the way, to even sell the machine, but to simply be able to provide services of being able to transfer the wires. Now, to set a kind of baseline on what you can do with recording on a pure metal medium, for those of you who are not familiar with this monster, wonderful machine that English Marconi came out with in 1935, the Marconi-Stiller Blattner phone, was a machine that was, it was bigger than that. I'm not big enough to spread, but this thing was a monster, and it ran at 1.5 meters a second. And, you know, sometimes I put that in writing, and right after it, I just say, no, that's not a typo. 1.5 meters per second, not on wire, but on what we would call tape. It was basically a flat substance, steel tape. And to give you an idea of what could be achieved with this kind of technology, I want you to hear the first sample that I brought. And this was done by the engineers at the Swedish radio company when I visited there almost 20 years ago. They were in the process of cannibalizing the three machines that they had into one that worked so that they could transfer whatever bonds, as they call them. We'd say bands. They didn't yet say ribbon or wire, tape. But here's a sample of one of these pre-war recordings running at 1.5 meters a second. That's track one, yes. Isn't that impressive?
Tystnad. Kamera. Film Doll Diggers of Broadway. Song Painting the Clouds with Sunshine.
Now, there's an example of extremely substantial bandwidth for the mid-1930s. There were some problems with that format that OSHA would have loved to have gotten their hands on. You had to have something similar to a tape bin duplicator loop in the front of the machine to handle the snapping of the medium, which was extremely tensile, running again at 1.5 meters per second. And this had to have a half inch thick plate glass cover on it, because when it broke, it might decapitate the operator. The size of the reel that ran 20 minutes was that, I don't know, 24 inches, 28 inches in diameter. In fact, the center hole for mounting the hub, I think, was roughly the size of a 7-inch reel of tape, to give you a point of view of perspective. But this demonstrates that you can and could record reliably on a pure metallic medium. So what I like to do is to approach a problem from the point of view of, let's try to excessively endeavor to get good results and let the sonic chips fall where they may. Instead of presuming that the results have to be mediocre or worse, let's really try for something good. And that way, if we are partially successful, something will come out of it. If we don't try, it's not going to happen. So in order to be able to quantify my experiments, I needed to be able to find a wire, any one wire, that was so nicely recorded that I could use it as a criterion for performance. And I couldn't. I simply couldn't find any good wires, or at least of musical content. They were typically recorded with these little ceramic handheld microphones, and you know what they sound like. So I did the next best thing. I traveled in my little time machine back to 1946. Because of my being an Ampex alumnus, I had access to the 30 IPS master of the only one surviving, the very first taped episode of the Philco radio show that was in the Ampex collection. And we had taped that back in the early 80s on an ATR-100. So to give you a baseline of what was being delivered to the console, whether it was a recording or a broadcast console at that period of time, I want you to hear just this clip of track 2 right off this 30 IPS tape.
Hey, Jerry, what are we sweeping up the studio for?
Bing Crosby is coming back on the air tonight.
Since when do we have to clean up a studio for him? With them baggy pants of his, he sweeps his own studio.
What's the matter with you? Ain't you heard? Things are gonna be different this year. He bought a belt.
That'll probably drag too.
Hi, fellas.
Well, Bing, hello.
Welcome home.
So that is what was being accomplished on a magnetophone with AC bias at that time. And I figured, well, a good test is, just to be a little corny about it, is to take something from that vintage and at least repertorially be accurate about the tests. So I then did a little connection to my Webcore 288, which I think was their top-of-the-line machine. It had 4 tubes in it. And went into the line input and copied the tape that you just heard onto a wire. And then I attempted to play the wire back on the Webcore to see, well, how well can it play it back? And this is an issue of electrical integrity of the signal. This is not an issue of wow and flutter concerns. Just when you take a state-of-the-art recording from the period of time that these machines were being shipped and delivered to people, and you took a high-fidelity signal and pumped it into it, what would you get back? Well, on the 288, you have line inputs, mic inputs, line outputs, and so forth. And the next cut is simply right off of the line output of the Webcore.
Hey, Jerry, what are we sweeping up the studio for?
Bing Crosby is coming back on the air tonight.
Since when do we have to clean up a studio for him? With them baggy pants of his, he sweeps his own studio.
What's the matter with you? Ain't you heard? Things are going to be different this year. He bought a belt.
Speaking of Crosby, I think he would have worn a shirt like this. According to You heard that tinkling, you heard the hum, you heard the strange nonlinear equalization and so forth that came off of the machine. Now, we take an Ampex 440. Charlie designs a thing to bob the wire up and down. The head is stationary. And we modify the capstan and pinch roller so that the system will provide the tension that I want and it will run at 24 IPS. This is that same wire with no electronic processing, the same wire coming right off of an Ampex head, right off of an Inovonix 376 reproduced electronics, and this is the difference of that same wire.
Hey, Jerry, what are we sweeping up the studio for?
Bing Crosby is coming back on the air tonight.
Since when do we have to clean up a studio for him? With them baggy pants of his, he sweeps his own studio.
What's the matter with you? Ain't you heard? Things are gonna be different this year. He bought a belt.
That'll probably drag too.
So you can hear right away what's happened here is all that metallic tinkling, that distortion, has been prevented. And as you well know, for purposes of archiving, what we want to do is to make optimal transfers of the original material so that future generations can hopefully play them back even better than we can now. And I don't consider it to be philosophically acceptable to take something like that and master it with some type of digital noise reduction, because whatever we have now is good. It's not as good as it will be, and it's better than what was. But why preclude further improvement by filtering out the hum, et cetera? And as you heard, for example, that hum is inherent to the way the machine made the recording. That hum is not coming out of the playback system. It's imparted into the wire. So what's been accomplished here is an ability to be able to take wire and get much better results out of it than if you tried to use the original machine, which goes back to my philosophical premise in the first place. Don't use original equipment when you can avoid it, assuming that you have the resources to make something better. Now, I believe the next cut is that sample, and this is going to be a little longer than the 30 seconds, but it's such a beautiful performance. I want you to hear this blues singer that was recorded with a handheld machine sometime around 46, 47 in the woods somewhere.
I'm so hungry, I want a piece of bread. I'm so hungry, till I'm almost dead. Best sip your meal and save your grand. It's a mighty poor living made in sandy land. I'd rather be dead. I'm so hungry, I'm almost dead. I'm so hungry, I want a piece of bread. Sip your meal, there's a mighty poor living in sandy land. I'd rather be dead than in my grave. And yeah, my baby, just crying for pig nose. Oh, my dog, our rooting save us so. The green grass growed up the little pig nose. How, my dog, how, my dog, let's go on and call the dog.
A lot of the, what I call it, I'm pronouncing this very clearly, so I'm not, you don't think I'm committing something inappropriate here, fucking, is when the wire has bends in it. And that would have been substantially more pronounced had it been played on an original machine with the head moving with less tension and so forth. I did find some wires with a machine that I bought in a junk store where if I see one of these things, I pick it up for parts and stuff. And it had some notes evidently by a chap who's writing a book on education, elementary school education at the time. And here is a brief excerpt of a surprisingly high quality one. I cannot believe this came off of a Webcor ceramic mic, but it was one of the wires that was packed in with the machine.
This is learned through participation in group activities, wherein children learn to appreciate and understand the opinions and feelings of one another. Next, we come to classroom routines. These are established habits. They are the basis of growth toward good discipline and control. It is important that children be given some share under teacher guidance and according to their age.
Now, you notice that the speed is relatively stable, especially on the portions with the music. And the way that I originally thought that I would accomplish that was to simply ape the time-honored tradition of the combination of the capstan and the pinch roller. And it certainly improved over the original, but in remembering the design of the MagnaCord SD-1, it had a wooden capstan. Now, that isn't as primitive as it might sound. It was a precisely machined part out of very hard wood, maybe cherry or something like that. Basically, it was a wheel with a V that drove the wire or regulated it. The principle of having a capstan and a pinch roller is that you have this stasis of stress, of motion, amongst the three elements, the tape, the capstan, and the pinch roller. Well, the problem with doing this on wire is that there is so little surface area to have that interaction be assured that it almost has no effect at all. So I changed the capstan design, taking advantage again of my little box of Ampex extra spares and so forth. I am a very big fan of the DC servo capstan motor technology that they had, and I simply took a capstan motor that was from a 440C, and we put a rubber shaft on it that is something on the order of 5 inches in diameter. I don't recall the exact measurement. But running the motor at its standard speed, whatever that RPM is, to produce a linear tape speed of 3 3/4 IPS, which is one of the fixed speeds, calculating what you need to run the wire at 24 IPS, the wire is wrapping around this tremendous, ridiculous-looking, oversized capstan, there is so much contact surface between the wire and the regulating medium that the speed becomes extremely stable. Now, obviously, we can't undo automatically the damage that was done when the recording was made in a speed-unstable manner, but at the very least, we know that we are not introducing any more speed distortions, and then somebody who is really skilled at establishing pitch and so forth can make those changes with a variable oscillator onto the reference servo input of the motor. So, coupled with the fact that the machine drives the wire under higher tension on this big rubber capstan at the speed that we require, or any odd speed, you can digitally program it, and can make the simple mechanical accommodations of one type of spool or another, it's fair to say that it is virtually a universal wire playback machine. The one thing that I have not had the thrill and privilege to do is to find an original telegraphone type of recording to try to play on it. And in fact, one of the pictures that you're not seeing here is of a telegraphone that's in the Seattle Museum of Telephony. And they have an original machine there with a reel of wire on it. And I hope to be able to eventually experiment with that to see what we could do with what is effectively, in a way, an acoustically recorded wire. But that in a nutshell, is what I've been up to. Thank you.
Those who were in Chicago remember we had Marvin Kamara speak, and he had a wire that he had recorded during the war in 1943 or 44 in his workshop of Marian Anderson. And that should be a wire that you'd work on. I have some New York Philharmonic broadcasts on some wires from 48 and or so. Gary?
That's a very good point. And well, the thing is that I can't find any equalization standard. So what I did was simply set it for the 15 IPS NAB curve.
Right.
Right.
The reduction in the high frequency noise and the more muted sibilance.
Right.
Well,
you see, it very well could be, and that to me is a subjective issue. I don't know what that curve should be, and just for the purpose of a test, just again as a baseline starting point, I use the 15 IPS NAB curve. And your question also reminds me of another critical point about why there is such severe limitation of high frequencies on wire, and that is that there is no azimuth stability, none whatsoever. The wire is constantly turning on its own axis, where, and of course that could be overcome by brute mechanical means such as a high linear speed. But when you take a head and you adjust that azimuth as it's playing, you don't hear any difference. Because it's running at 24 IPS to begin with. So there is a very big subjective interpretational issue here of what equalization do you run it at, and also what optimal way is there to set that head. And in all the paperwork that I have looked at from the Armor Foundation and so forth, I have not been able to find specs on the equalization curve. So I just don't know.
You gotta be very quick. We're very, very late.
You've compared the web core and its various iterations with your new system.
Yeah.
What about the other wire recorder systems of the period that were widely used? The General Electric, which is
GE Utah, the Lawrence
no,
School.
The General Electric Model 50, which was a professional machine.
Right, and which has a wonderful transport system.
Yes. Yes.
So some of the quality of the other stuff, I think, is much better than the web core.
Absolutely.
It might be useful simply to have a winding device to take the stuff off the web core, put it onto a GE if you have a GE to work with, rather than go the whole 10, 12 yards to your equipment. I realize that you're giving up some aspect of it, but you are making a substantial improvement. The other question is, can you mount all these other systems on your machine for playback, or do they have to be wound onto some universal real feed in order to work on your machine?
It accepts the original reels in their various diameters and core sizes. In theory, well, yeah, except for the cartridges. Those would have to be extracted, or, again, nothing's mechanically impossible other than turning a sphere inside out, I suppose. So you could make these accommodations. A professional machine such as a GE number 50, for example, would perform substantially better than a web core. I have been unable to find one to put in operating order. And that is the problem. But even so, I would still go for superior electronics. If the GE transport ran satisfactorily, I would not, If I had one that I could, well, then there would be a question of, can I modify it non-destructively and keep the artifact intact? Maybe yes, maybe no. But say that I could, it would have avoided a lot of expensive machining to do that. Absolutely. But I still would change the electronics, and the electronics certainly can be changed non-destructively. The early heads had some pretty significant shielding problems that would introduce hum and so forth.
There's not a whole lot of hum on those things.
Well, there's just...
There's one significant problem, however, that the WebCor does not have, and that is that the GE did not use a stainless steel wire, and every so often, I just ran into a batch of them where half of them were rusted.
That's exactly... Well, that was, you see, but that was not a function of General Electric. That was a function of the wire that was available to them. Prior to Armor specifying the stainless steel that was being used, it was all ferric, rustable material. And by the way, I learned something in doing some research about this, and that I was always under the impression that stainless steel is non-magnetic. How do you record magnetically on something that's non-magnetic? Well, it turns out, after consulting a metallurgist, that if you take this kind of steel, aluminum included, and when you're in the process of extruding it and enduring enough pressure that the lattice structure of the material itself becomes asymmetrical and therefore becomes magnetizable. And I didn't know that, but you can have magnetic stainless steel. And the earlier wires, absolutely, and this would be quite a challenge, how do you handle wire that is so thin that has rusted? I.
One last question, very quickly.
I was always under the impression that the reason for the high frequency problem with wire was not the absence of, like you think of in tape machines, but the fact that you never know which part of the wire is.
Because it was round instead of flat.
Because the wire tends to rotate.
Exactly, it's continually rotating on its axis. Well, I'll tell you what I did try, and it didn't produce any significant improvement. I tried sandwiching it between two heads wired 180 degrees out of phase to at least get two sides, two perspectives of the field, and it didn't make any significant improvement. And aligning the heads was a pain, not to get any delay, of course, as a result. But the point being that because it's a homogeneous substance and it's not stratified such as all tapes are other than the IG Farben tapes, the field permeated the entire wire.
Yeah.
So that just so long as it's in adequate proximity to the gap of the head, it plays. And I had thought about that azimuth thing, and at least the double head situation didn't help it. Maybe some type of a head that would be a toroid that it passed through might help it. I don't know, but that's something to be thought about.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take exactly 60 minutes for lunch. Let me just say that, unfortunately, Lenoir Hall is closed today. So some of you might want to go up to Franklin Street. Some